Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're getting into a topic that I think has fascinated pretty much everyone at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Mm-hmm. Sadly.
If you're anything like us, you've probably looked at those incredible carvings on a temple wall and just thought, how on earth did that actually work?
Well, that's exactly what we're here to figure out. We're going to try and move past, you know, the mystery and the movie tropes.
Right.
The goal here is to really uncover the logical, sophisticated system that was the bedrock of Egyptian civilization for, what, over 3,000 years?
And for this deep dive, we've been immersing ourselves in the work of Dr. Penelope Wilson. She is a top-tier Egyptologist, and she just cuts through this old idea that hieroglyphs were like primitive pictures.
She really does. She reveals them as one of humanity's most complex and, frankly, enduring communication systems.
Her whole approach seems to be that the script had this dual purpose. It wasn't just one thing.
Exactly. It was a practical tool, you know, for administration, for taxes, but it was also the sacred art form. It gave words real power, sometimes even magical power. We'll break down the mechanics, but we also have to get into that cultural weight.
Okay, so before we get into the nuts and bolts of the script itself, we should probably talk about the author. Tell us a bit about Dr. Penelope Wilson.
Dr. Wilson is a really formidable figure in her field. She's the professor of Egyptian archaeology at Durham University.
Okay.
But what makes her perspective so unique, so powerful, isn't just the academic rigor, though she has that in spades.
So what is it? What's her unique angle?
It's this combination of two things. She has this deep linguistic expertise, philology, they call it, the study of historical texts. But she combines that with years of hands-on archaeological field work.
Ah, so she's not just in a library analyzing texts.
Not at all. She's been out there in the dirt. She's famously directed the big archaeological project at Sais in the Nile Delta.
That must give her a totally different perspective.
It's a complete holistic view. She understands the script on like a whole spectrum, from the huge, perfect hieroglyphs carved into a temple, which were designed to last forever.
Right, for eternity.
All the way down to these quick little notes scribbled on pottery shards, which the Egyptians called ostraca. So she connects the theory of the language directly to the, you know, the messy reality of the people who used it.
That makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's unpack her central argument. What were hieroglyphs, really?
Well, she argues they were this incredibly sophisticated, multifaceted system, not just for one purpose. They were doing administration, religion, and cultural memory all at the same time.
And the key, the thing that unlocks it all, is that it wasn't one type of writing. For centuries, people were stuck on that, right?
Yes, completely stuck. Scholars kept insisting it had to be either purely symbolic, so pictures for ideas, or purely phonetic, signs for sounds.
But the genius was that it was both.
It was a hybrid system. That's the core thesis. It blends logographic signs, which are those idea pictures, with phonetic signs for sounds. And then there's a third layer, determinatives, that sort of guides the reader.
And this system lasted for an unbelievable amount of time.
I mean, the historical arc is just staggering. It starts around 3200 BCE, right around the unification of Egypt. It evolved through the old, middle, and new kingdoms, and only really falls out of use in the Roman period.
3,000 years. That's just mind-boggling longevity.
It really is.
Okay, let's dive into the mechanics, because I think this is where the big aha moment happens for a lot of people. Wilson breaks it down into this tripartite structure: logograms, phonograms, and determinatives. Let's start with the easy one.
Logograms.
Yeah.
Right. This is the most straightforward part. You draw a picture of the sun, and it means sun.
A direct one-to-one picture of a thing.
Exactly. A visual representation. But, you know, that has its limits. How do you draw a picture of love or believe or an abstract idea?
And that's where the phonograms, the sound signs, come in. This is the big intellectual leap, using what's called the rebus principle.
The rebus principle is such a clever idea. You use a picture not for the thing it shows, but for the sound it makes.
Like drawing an I and a B to mean I believe.
That's a perfect modern example. For the Egyptians, the sign for house was pronounced prar. So they started using that house sign to write the pri sound. In other words, even if those words had nothing to do with houses.
They were basically spelling with pictures.
Precisely. And within that category of sound signs, you find the most amazing part. The uniliteral signs.
The what signs?
Uniliteral. It means one letter. There were about 24 of these signs, and each one stood for a single consonant sound. You know, a horned viper for F, a wavy line of water for N. It was, for all intents and purposes, an alphabet.
So wait, this is what blows my mind. They had an alphabet. They had all the tools they needed for a simple, efficient phonetic script. But they just chose not to use it on its own.
They chose to keep the complexity. It's incredible.
Why not just simplify?
Because it wasn't just about efficiency. It was about culture, art, and sacred power. To boil it all down to 24 simple signs would have stripped away the artistic beauty and the connection to the divine. They valued tradition over pure utility.
The medium really was the message for them. The script itself was a statement. Okay, so that brings us to the third layer, the one that makes it all clear. The determinatives.
Yes, the determinatives. They are such an elegant solution to a problem. Because the script didn't usually write vowels, you'd end up with tons of words that sounded the same, homophones.
Right.
So the determinative is a silent sign. You don't pronounce it. You put it at the end of a word, and it tells you the word's general category.
Okay, give me an example.
So if you spelled out the sounds, that could mean either to write or papyrus scroll. You'd add a little picture of a man writing at the end of the word to mean to write, or you'd add a picture of a tied-up scroll to mean papyrus.
It's like a category tag. It removes all the ambiguity.
That's the perfect way to put it. It's a semantic tag, and it was absolutely essential for clarity.
But just being clear wasn't enough, was it? It also had to be beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. Wilson really stresses that you cannot separate the script from the visual arts. They were one and the same.
And this is where we get the rules about how to read it, which are so intuitive when you hear them.
The directionality rule is just beautiful. You always read into the faces of the figures. So if the people and the animals are facing left, you read from left to right.
And if they face right?
You read from right to left. It meant the text on a temple wall always flowed visually inward toward the image of the god or the king. It was about symmetry and respect.
So it's functional, but it's also architectural. It shows the scribe was an artist, not just a clerk.
Totally. And they would group the signs into these imaginary squares or rectangles called quadrats, just to make sure the whole block of text looked balanced and beautiful.
All of this reinforces that idea of the scribe as this elite, powerful figure. Literacy was the key to power.
They were the cultural custodians, the bureaucrats, the artists. But carving those beautiful formal hieroglyphs into stone was, well, it was slow.
Right, not very practical for everyday business.
Exactly. So for day-to-day stuff, they needed something faster, and this is how the script evolved.
They came up with cursive versions.
They did. For writing on papyrus with a brush, they developed hieratic, which was a much simpler, more flowing script, and then later, an even more abbreviated version called demotic for things like letters and contracts.
So they had the right tool for the right job. Formal for eternity. Cursive for the everyday.
Masters of code switching, you could say.
Let's shift gears a bit to the great intellectual detective story here, the decipherment. For something like 1,400 years, the script was silent. Nobody can read it.
An incredible silence. And then in 1799, the discovery of the Rosetta Stone, game changer.
Because it was the same text written in three different scripts.
Right. Hieroglyphs at the top, demotic in the middle, and crucially, ancient Greek at the bottom. And since scholars could read Greek, they finally had a key.
Now, a lot of people worked on it, but the final breakthrough belongs to Jean-François Champollion in 1822.
Champollion's genius was that he figured out the core idea we just talked about. He was the one who realized the system was a hybrid.
It wasn't just one thing.
He saw that when they wrote a foreign name, like Ptolemy, they used the purely phonetic alphabetic signs.
But for a native Egyptian name like Rameses, it was different.
Totally different. They'd use the picture sign for the god Ra, the sun disk,
yeah,
and then spell out the rest of the name phonetically. He saw that they blended the systems, and that was the key.
And he had a secret weapon, didn't he?
He did. His knowledge of Coptic. Coptic was the last stage of the ancient Egyptian language, written with the Greek alphabet. It preserved the sounds and the vocabulary. It was the linguistic bridge he needed to finally hear the voice of ancient Egypt again.
Just an amazing story. So, pulling this all together, what are the key themes that Wilson really wants us to take away?
I think the first big one is that writing was a sacred, almost performative act for them.
It wasn't just about recording things. It was about making things happen.
Yes, exactly. To write a name or a spell in a tomb on something like the Book of the Dead was to literally activate its power, to ensure the person's eternal life. The act of carving it beautifully had real spiritual consequences.
The second theme seems to be this inseparable link between the script and the culture itself.
Right. The hieroglyphs just embody the Egyptian worldview. their obsession with eternity, with order, what they called Mat.
Mat. Truth, justice, cosmic order.
And the very structure of the writing system reflects that desire to maintain Mat against chaos. The script was a cultural treasure, not just a neutral tool.
And the third theme is that balance between conservation and innovation. They kept the ancient sacred signs, but still developed new, efficient scripts for daily life.
They adapted without abandoning their tradition. It's why it lasted 3,000 years.
You know, the book is just full of ideas that really stick with you. There's one idea from Wilson that I think captures it all perfectly.
Go.
She basically says, hieroglyphs were never merely writing. They were a way of seeing and understanding the world that combined practical communication with sacred power and artistic beauty.
That's it in a nutshell, and it highlights the challenge. She says something like, to read hieroglyphs properly, one must think like an Egyptian.
You can't impose our modern, purely utilitarian view of writing onto their system.
Oh, way. And the most powerful, almost chilling example of that power is the practice of damnatio memoria.
Tell us about that.
It's the act of deliberately erasing an enemy's name from monuments. For them, this wasn't just censorship. It was believed to literally obliterate their existence in the afterlife.
Wow. An eternal death sentence.
Delivered by chisel. It just shows how real and potent they believed the written word to be.
So if we step back, what can this ancient system really teach us today?
Well, Wilson's analysis has some surprising applications. For one, it helps us understand our own communication systems.
You mean like emojis? I was just thinking that.
Exactly. Think about how you use emojis. They function almost identically to those ancient determinatives.
How so?
Well, you write a short, maybe ambiguous text, and then you add a little picture, a smiling face, a thumbs up, to clarify the emotional tone, the semantic category of the words.
That's a fantastic connection. They use a visual cue because they didn't have vowels, and we use a visual cue because our texts are so abbreviated.
It's the same solution to a similar problem thousands of years apart. Another lesson is from the decipherment itself. To understand any complex system, whether it's a company culture or a political movement, you have to drop your own assumptions and try to see it from the inside.
Just like Champollion had to do. And I think there's a third one, too. The evolution from formal stone carvings to quick papyrus notes. It kind of mirrors our own digital history, doesn't it? From formal print to instant messaging.
Our tools shape our style. It's a timeless principle.
For me, the most fascinating thing to come out of all this was that realization about the alphabet, that they had one of those 24 uniliteral signs just sitting there.
And they made a conscious choice.
They consciously chose complexity and beauty and tradition over what would have been easy. That says so much about them.
It really defines their civilization.
Yeah.
Hieroglyphs just change your whole idea of what writing can be. It wasn't just for recording reality. For them, it was a technology for creating and sustaining reality.
So here's a final thought for you to take away. The next time you use an emoji to clarify a quick text message, that little silent sign that classifies the meaning of the words around it.
Consider how closely its function mirrors the ancient Egyptian determinative, a key feature of a 3,000-year-old writing system that was both sacred art and a tool for getting things done.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.